Welcome to the Design the Future podcast, where we talk with women leading the way towards a better built world. Design the Future is hosted by me, Lindsay Baker, with Kira Gould. Let's get started.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Design the Future podcast. It's good to be with you. This is Lindsay.
And this is Kira.
And yeah, here we are. How are you, Kira? How's it going?
It's going very well, but I'm eager to hear from you since you have been conferencing lately, and I did not get to go to the Living Future conference this year, much to my deep disappointment. So it seemed like it was quite a fun time just watching it on socials. So tell me all about it.
I think it was quite a fun time. I mean, I keep telling people we had a lot to live up to. Like, people really feel strongly about the Living Future conference.
Indeed.
So, and this was my first time as the CEO hosting it in person, which is just a totally different thing than the virtual one that we did last year. So it felt great to be back in person. And I feel like, at least so far, I mean, people are always nice in person, so we'll wait and see how the feedback really is in writing. Like, people had a lot of fun. And I think, I mean, we just had wonderful speakers, really amazing people who came to share stories with us. And I think it was also cool. Like, a lot of people came up to me who listened to the podcast. Oh. And so, yeah, shout out and thank you all for that opportunity to say hello in person. I think what was cool about it was, so my opening address to the community, I talked a lot about sort of the role that we, well, I talked a little bit about like our, you know, our question that we always ask about people being a part of a movement versus being a part of an industry, and sort of the role that we as practitioners take on to, that we need to take on, not just in the designing and the building of buildings, but then in sort of the advocacy that happens to change the systems around us. And so that was sort of the theme of the conference in many ways, and really resonated with people. It was great to hear all the stories of all the people in the community that are kind of, you know, once they build a building, they walk local policymakers around the building and talk to them about how, you know, like why we need to build this way. So it was really cool to get a chance to be in person with folks and like talk about that issue that we talk about on the pod, I think, a fair amount. And we may have some new listeners. If you're new, welcome.
That's great. That's wonderful. That resonates with me. That's why I really wanted to go. I believe this was the first Living Future to be held on the East Coast.
It
was in DC. So I'm sure that also a lot of folks that maybe haven't gone in the past or haven't always gone in the past got to come. And I really wanted to be there because I've been thinking a lot about this idea of advocacy and how it takes so many different forms. I'm running a session at the American Institute of Architects conference on becoming a citizen architect. And I've been thinking a lot about all the different ways that takes shape in a practice and in a firm and for within a career, you know, like all the ways that can happen. So I would have loved to see it and hear it and be a part of that. I'm so glad it was a success. Congratulations.
I'm so excited for your session at the AIA conference. That sounds really great too, Kira, because I do think it's a time people are really interested in this stuff. And I also think like we're ILFI, we're going to have a call with some folks from AIA to see what we can learn about the way that AIA has really engaged specifically around, you know, climate advocacy.
Yes.
I think there's just really cool work happening there. So
there is. And I'm really proud of what the role that the Committee on the Environment has sort of taken in that over the years, in part because there's so much interesting activity happening in the local chapters, frankly. And now National is really kind of harnessing that. So it's very exciting. Anyway, now we're getting wonky into the AIA stuff. A little creepy, but it's all good. Very exciting. Very, very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we can get wonky over here, but it's good to know that people are starting to hear the thread of conversation that we have here on the pod with so many different amazing leaders who I think it is kind of getting to be a trend. I mean, honestly, I don't know that we really have ever had a guest who said, you know, I just do my day job and then I check out.
That's right. That's right. So, well, yeah. Yes. And that is certainly true for our guest today. We are so excited to welcome Renee Chang to the podcast today. Hello, Renee.
Hi there. Good to join you today.
Thank you so much for being with us. I'm going to do a quick intro and then we'll jump into questions. Renee Chang is an architect and dean of the College of Built Environments at the University of Washington. She pioneered research surrounding the intersection of design and emerging technologies. She's a leader in the American Institute of Architects and an advocate for equity in the field of architecture and in the practices related to the built environment. Recently, she led the research effort for the AIA Guides for Equitable Practice in the Workplace. Renee, we're thrilled to have you with us, and we'd like to learn about how and why you got involved in architecture and education. Tell us about your path.
Yeah, thanks. So there's a slightly different path on why I got involved with architecture compared to education. So I got involved with architecture really thinking about housing, affordable housing. And it's interesting that I've kind of been getting engaged with that topic again, but in from a very different perspective than I thought, because I thought I would be more practicing on it, but it ends up being more supporting research and kind of advocating for ways that our college can show new models and do things in our community or in our country. The path to education was really, as I was practicing, I realized that there were the impact that I could have might be greater if I was working with students and studying the profession, because there was a lot of change going on at that time. So when I first started practicing, and I had my own practice for a while, I worked for a number of really famous firms that learned a lot, but there were a lot of things changing in the field or potential to change. And so I started really, first of all, missing teaching, because I taught when I was in graduate school, taught drawing, and really missed that while I was practicing. And then there were some massive changes in representation at the time where BIM was pretty new. And there was a lot of potential for it to go beyond just a simple representation or kind of digital version of drawing to data. And the potential for that to open up new ways of thinking, not only for sustainability, performance, but also just for designers to be able to communicate differently, was super exciting. And there weren't actually a lot of people doing research on it. People in practice were certainly learning and trying to implement it, but there were things that I felt like academia could actually provide that neutral perspective that wasn't really saying this is how we should do it exactly, but more curious about the kinds of questions that it offered. So in hindsight, it makes a lot of sense that when I explain it, I started teaching around construction and drawing and representation. BIM really led to looking at lean and innovative practices, which led to integrated project delivery and the contractual ways that we work together collaboratively, which then really interwove with equity issues and how we work across different cultural differences and the kind of technology and social implications of what we do as architects. So you can explain it in hindsight, like, oh, it all made sense. It was all logical, linear. But really, it was a lot more unclear at the time that I was navigating it. Really, the kind of thing that kind of guided me through was a love of teaching and a willingness to see design at many scales, including the design of curriculum and design of experiences for students and working collaboratively with peers, as well as thinking of students as partners and professionals as partners as well.
I love this, Renee. I love this idea of like the students as partners, but also just sort of how much thoughtfulness and passion you're bringing to just the question of teaching and curriculum design and all of that. It's exciting, and I can see how you found the right path for you. So I guess maybe a next question for you on this front is what you might advise for people in the profession who might be considering teaching more, higher education as a profession. What should they be good at or interested in, or what kind of people work well in that environment?
Right. So I think the answer has been evolving, right? So when I talk to folks that are interested in teaching, and we have a lot of practitioners in every school that I've ever taught, there's been amazing practitioners that have found ways to teach part-time while keeping a full-time practice going. And so some of them ask, you know, what would it take to really shift into full-time teaching, which gets into whole issues of, you know, the structural ways that you apply for positions and things about academia. But I think in general, when people are talking about just blending teaching with whatever they're doing or why one gets into teaching or stays in teaching, I think it's helpful to have something to teach beyond what you yourself were taught. And so when a student comes to me and says, you know, really what they love is wanting to continue to be in academia, but they haven't even graduated yet. And I usually say, you know, go out to practice or to nonprofits or get experiences beyond what you yourself learned in school, because you can definitely teach from what you learned in school. But after a certain point, that well potentially runs dry. And so how do you feed the other parts of your curiosity and the kind of connections that you see to be able to work with your students in ways that are different than the way you yourself was taught? And I think that's especially true nowadays because I've been teaching, I was just counting the years. I think it's been close to 30 years now. And over that time, I think I've seen a widening gap between generations so that the students that are in school now are facing practice opportunities and practice realities that are really radically different than the kinds of practice that certainly I faced when I was graduating. And so that gap between those of us that are teaching, and certainly there are people that are teaching that are newer to teaching than me, but that gap between the practice that we as teachers experienced or our perceptions of practice and the practice that the students are going to be experiencing as they graduate in 2, 3, 4, or 5 years is a widening gap. And so we are then now faced as educators of not teaching a particular type of practice or even particular types of technology, but inspiring in our students the kind of willingness to keep learning, principles by which they can make choices, and openness to things that we can't even imagine right now. And so we're not teaching them facts. We're teaching them, or what Josef Albers sometimes called factual facts versus actual facts, right? So factual facts are 2 + 2 = 4, but an actual fact is 2 + 2 = 5 or more. And he used to put his two fingers together, one finger and one finger, and you put them together and there's a space between that becomes a third thing, right? And so the idea that we're teaching these actual facts, like principles, values, ways of working, methodologies, ways of seeing, ways of querying, those are absolutely the thing that people need to be thinking about when they want to go into teaching.
I think that's so important. It's just funny to me thinking about this point about the generational gaps. I was talking with some folks on my board recently about their experiences when they were in school for architecture, you know, 30, 40 years ago or more. And it's just amazing how much that educational experience has changed. And it's great to hear, I think, the way that you're approaching it and staying focused on, well, yeah, really making sure that the educational experience stays in touch with and very much reflects the profession itself. It makes so much sense. Probably there's a lot more there we could talk about, but I wonder if you can also just share with us in sort of a similar vein, you're the dean of this College of Built Environments. What can you say about the people entering these fields today in the built environment fields? What are they thinking about? What kind of people are entering in, and what are you noticing about, I don't know, just the community coming into the profession?
So some things have changed and some things have not. And some of the things that have not changed are good and traditions that we want to value and are part of our culture. And some things that haven't changed really need to change. And they're maybe structural or kind of built in. And I think what we're seeing now is this, because the gap of the practice experience of those that might be teaching and the kind of their perceptions of practice versus the students' practice that they're going to be entering is big. We're just getting to the things that we always should be teaching anyway, of the kind of curiosity, the methodology, those principles. And so when I talk to students that are in school today or considering school or just recently graduated, they come with, you know, and I think students have always been, and this may be just part of the intrinsic nature of a student at whatever chronological age they might happen to be, when you're in school and you're being primed with all these great prompts and ways of thinking about things, and you're with peers that are also in that situation, it's a period of incredible intellectual awakening and activity and kind of intensity. And so when students today are, so students, I think, are always wanting to change the world, wanting to think differently, have others think differently, inspire others to think differently. But maybe what's more pointed today are the disparities that we see relative to the built environments and the impact built environments has on communities, on housing, on wealth, on prosperity, are just even more stark and potentially more so after the twin pandemics or triple pandemic, whatever you want to think of it, with COVID and the George Floyd murder and economic crises. And there's just a lot, it's just a lot more stark that there are these built environment impacts that have accelerated and in some cases perpetuated disparities when could the built environment could be elevating more folks in more ways. And so I see an urgency of students, and I talk to students that say, you know, ever since we were in kindergarten, people have told us climate is going to be our generation's problem to solve. And that is both inspiring to them as well as super intimidating of you have been saddled since you were in grade school with the idea that the older generation has messed things up and are just now starting to realize that it's really the younger generation that's going to solve these problems, either through behavioral change, technological change, policy changes, built environment changes, right? But we don't actually know exactly how to do it. And so some of it is, yeah, generationally in terms of time, they, you know, the people that are just entering the profession now have 20 or 30 years of a career in front of them, whereas those like me do not have that decades. But that pressure goes both ways, where it's inspiring, but it's also really intimidating. And so supporting students through that and having them see how they might be able to navigate it individually as well as collectively is really a different way of supporting and takes a certain resilience and a willingness to ask for help, willingness to say you don't know, the ability to work across cultural differences, whether those are disciplinary differences, because architects increasingly are going to need to work with public health folks, with policy people, material scientists. And so the ability to work across those disciplines has always been valued but not taught. And so the more we can teach that, I think the better off our students are going to be when they graduate.
I love the idea of teaching that. I think that's so incredibly powerful, Renee, in so many ways. Because yeah, I do think that these are the kinds of things we're called upon to do in our profession over time. And to for people to start hearing that is part of the work, you know, that's part of the role when they're in school, it feels like such an important foundation to make sure that we then go out there and do that interdisciplinary work, as you're saying. I was just thinking about this last week, or saying to some folks that sometimes it can be hard for me to hear, as you know, I'm not an architect, I'm a you know, environmentalist and person in it for the change. And sometimes you hear architects say, oh well, we're really a service profession, we're doing what we were asked to mm-hmm. do with a client, right? Yeah. And to me, when I look at architects as a community, I think they're vastly underselling themselves when they say that.
Because 100%, yeah. I absolutely agree.
But I think the way you're talking about educating and sort of providing that context for students coming up into the professions of built environment professions, hopefully we'll change that attitude, you know, or keep that from happening.
I think the agency of knowing what your role is, and I do hear from architects that feel like they're the central collaborators, and it's the kind of the conductor of the orchestra that can pull in the engineers and the client perspectives and the community perspectives. And so I do think that there are architects that see that as their role, but many of them don't feel specifically trained in it. Right. They might be really skilled and really experienced in it, but many of them will say that they learned it on the job, or they kind of had a great mentor, when there are actually measurements for how facile you are or how fluent you are in working interculturally. So that's kind of bridging to cultural both language and behavioral. And there's a ton of research around culturally based aspects of time and about, you know, documentation, for example. And when you're in, particularly for the wicked problems like affordable housing, sustainable affordable housing, climate solutions, you have to be able to talk to an oceanographer about sea level rise and a native community that's potentially getting federal funding to relocate because of sea level rise, right? So those are very diverse perspectives with different agendas, different language, different perceptions of funding, of time. And so that's really where architects can excel, and there is training. You don't have to feel like the only way to learn that is through a mentor or through experience. And you are going to make mistakes, but that's not the only way to learn.
Yeah, I love everything about it. Making the method clear. I think it's also sort of a form of opening up the profession, frankly, to sort of, there can be a lot of that in architecture, but in other professions as well, the way that we say like, oh, well, you just either have it or you don't, you know?
Right, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, well, we could talk a lot more about that, but we want to get into your work a little bit more, into I guess, what it's like to be you on a day-to-day basis. Can you tell us maybe what you're most proud of accomplishing in your work life? And it can be more personal or more professional, whatever rings true for you.
Yeah, so there's so many things that I can talk about for sure. I actually find my work life incredibly fulfilling and feel so fortunate to have had, as I said, in hindsight, the path makes sense. You can explain it in a linear way. But at the time, there were a lot of choices I made that may or may not have led me to where I am today. So I actually feel extremely fortunate and grateful. And some of that has to do with just serendipity, and some has been amazing mentors and support and partners that I've had over time. But I would say that in terms of accomplishments, the AIA Guides was really such a large part of my life over the past couple of years, and really pulled together a lot of the things that I had been working on in terms of, you know, how people work together and how they work together, whether it's on a super challenging technical issue or whether it's a difficult to define social issue, but just how do you work together? And so some of the things that I had been, you know, learning and maybe not realizing I was learning kind of came together in the guides. And then the guides was an amazing body of research to dig into from social science and from business and anthropology, as well as education. And so if you are nerdy enough to actually read bibliography or the footnotes in the guides, they're extensive. And the annotated resources, for example, we explain, you know, why these things kind of rose to the top of things we want everyone to know about and why. But the footnotes are also, again, if you want to go into them, they're pretty fascinating. And sometimes we did commentary in those. And so learning about some of those pieces that I kind of had known were out there. But my undergraduate background was psychology. And so reading some of the psychology and social relations type research and organizational type things for business was really helpful to put it together with stuff that I had been observing in practice for a long time and in education. And so the guides, not only on practice, but we recently did the supplement on justice and a supplement on equity in higher education. And so that body of work in the guides is something that has been really fulfilling to be working on. The other one that I would say is the research practice consortia that I started in Minnesota that's still going, and the one that we founded here in Seattle, where students link with practitioners and faculty to work collaboratively on projects that really advance the discipline and bring research practices into something that's very actionable. And so that framework that we set up, I've actually witnessed cultural change in how offices consider research and consider how to engage students as, again, this kind of partnership and giving them leadership and agency beyond a kind of entry-level intern with the support of faculty and practitioners. So that has been incredible to see that kind of shift of language around research and practice, as well as the kind of that cultural change that I've seen happening around the guides. So I think it's hard to influence culture. And, you know, having the perspective of 30 years or so of teaching and more, if you consider teaching and practicing, it is gratifying to see that there are signs of slow but meaningful cultural shifts.
Renee, that's so powerful, both on both fronts. And it's so needed too. The research piece is incredibly important. I think there is a I mean, it has to be said, this profession does not take research nearly as seriously as we need to be. And so there's such a gap. There's so much room for improvement there. And I am so pleased to learn a little bit about the consortia that you just mentioned. And the guides, I'm a little bit closer to, because I am that nerd. I loved your bibliography.
Great. Someone's reading it.
I must also say that the guides included, and I particularly have been looking at the justice one because I've been working within AIA, with the Committee on the Environment, around climate action and climate justice, and wanting to make sure that we're aligning with other ways of defining justice more broadly, et cetera. All the things, those things are so important, but the language around it is important too. And I so appreciated the glossary.
Yeah, that glossary. Yeah, it was.
Well, we're so bad at saying what we're talking about. Like, especially in that category, there are so many words that people use casually without.
Or as euphemisms without naming what they really mean. And so that glossary is not definitive by any means, but it's a great starting point by which you could argue or disagree or have different nuances. But yeah, language around equity and justice issues, you can end up having long, unfruitful discussions because you didn't spend the time aligning on what do you mean by certain words. And so trying to get people on a stronger basis for the tough discussions is really what we were hoping with that glossary. And if you're super, super nerdy, you would actually realize that the first edition of the guides is pretty different than the second edition. Mm-hmm. So the second edition, we started the guides right around the time of Me Too.
Yep.
And we released the second edition about a year after George Floyd's murder. Mm-hmm. And so many firms had come out with statements saying we stand with and were not clear then what does that mean?
Right.
And so the second edition and then the justice supplement really went a lot further in social justice and being able to advocate and giving people more language, more ways to actually implement some of the things that they were, the values that they were committed to.
Yeah, absolutely. I work with so many firms that want to say lots of things, but they don't even know what they haven't defined the words for themselves. So I'm like, you don't say it publicly.
You actually shouldn't say
what it means. Yeah. You know, it drives me bananas. And I think it's actually more problematic than, especially around those topics, than saying little or nothing, because it's they're just not sure what they're saying. And so I so appreciated so many things about those, and I won't nerd out further on AIA matters, but it really, they're very, very meaningful and worthwhile. I would just, for those who haven't tapped into those, I would really check them out. But we did want to ask you, Renee, if there's a project that you're working on now that you'd like our listeners to know about.
Yeah, thanks. It's actually kind of an extension or a way to, manifest some of the things that I've been interested in around the guides and around my career over time, is the space that we're in right now in my College of Built Environments here at University of Washington is not unlike a number of architecture schools or even campuses around the country, where there's been a lot of deferred maintenance over time. Our buildings were built in the 60s and 70s when, or even earlier, when students had different life patterns, right? They came to school, they went to lectures, they met up with their friends, they were often living really close by, they would do their homework at libraries or in their dorm rooms. And our students today are being asked and want to do work in very different ways in how they learn and interact. Many of the students that I encounter are working not just on one collaborative project, but four collaborative projects with different teams or each of those projects. And so they are trying to figure out how and when to try to leave their stuff or collaborate or over Zoom or find times to meet in person. And they're also working on research projects either with faculty or, with the research consortium. And so they're needing to find space. And so, they're collaborating in spaces that were really meant for hallways or circulation or in cafes, right, which are really noisy and can work fine, but aren't necessarily the kinds of collaboration spaces you sometimes see in architecture offices or in other collaborative, innovative spaces around where people are working on difficult problems. And so the misalignment between spaces of higher education and the kinds of principles, to say nothing of many of our buildings are incredibly poorly performing in terms of their energy use, but they embody tons of carbon because they were built to last, and some of them have been able to adapt to different types of programmatic use. Mm-hmm. Some are less successful. There's also a sense of haves and have-nots, because some of the newer buildings with better funding, maybe of majors that have more corporate sponsorship or other types of partnership, have nicer furniture, better lighting.
Yep.
And the buildings that are older start to look pretty shabby in comparison. And so we're actually using our college as an example to be working, and we've been super fortunate to do work with Karen Timberlake and collaborating with the College of Engineering diversity lead, Karen Thomas Brown. We're actually presenting on this work at AIA in San Francisco. And so I'm really, and I'm speaking about it all through our university and also at things like the Society of Campus and Urban Planners, and really trying to elevate this topic, which so many universities are struggling with: deferred maintenance, mm-hmm. buildings that don't match the pedagogical goals, and the embodied carbon of our campuses that really need to be invested in. And so trying to figure out how to do this with equity in mind, thinking about what do the students feel supported? How do they feel that they belong, that this is a place that they can be safe to say things or do things that maybe they don't in more conventional environments? So that is really, I'm super excited to work on, and I'm, you know, kind of starting in my own backyard first, but using it as an exemplar for the rest of this university and hopefully others.
That's great. And I think that's going to be an exciting session. I'm looking forward to catching that, Renee. I love that, especially the issue of sort of disparity between departments and how you can address some of those things as part of that. I want to shift gears just a little bit, kind of zoom out a little and talk about, well, I think that sustainability and equity in the built environment community, they're often thought of as movements. And I'm wondering if you feel like you're part of an industry or a movement or both, and how do you think about that?
Yeah, I was listening a little bit to you and Lindsay chatting before about those kinds of, first of all, I don't think it's a polarity, right? And I don't think you guys were saying it was, where you have to choose one or the other. I do think that we are a values-based movement where we're trying to work collectively towards goals. But I also think we're an industry, and particularly in North America, we're a capitalist-based industry, that there is the potential to put value on things in terms of dollars and investments that have payoffs. We don't always need to think in terms of dollars, but we have different ways that we can say there are different ways to think about that return on investment, whether it's to do with prosperity or kind of wellness or life expectancy, right? But there are ways that we can talk about these things that don't put the kind of industry part of needing to actually practice and move forward with things and find clients that have fees that pay for outcomes with the movement part of advocacy or feeling collective benefit and, you know, sharing things like research across different projects and different firms across different fields, right? So I definitely don't think of it as a binary, but that they are polarities, that we exist in both, and that they have the potential where they're intention at times and the potential where they're synergistic at times. And these are things that we need to navigate. What I'm definitely seeing that in terms of climate and climate solutions, one of the, you know, backhanded benefits of global warming and the kind of very extreme weather conditions that are just rising to the public awareness is there's just much more acceptance that yes, climate solutions are urgently needed. Whether or not it's enough and enough urgency is another question, but there's just more general popular understanding and appreciation. And we're fortunate here in Washington State to have Jay Inslee as the governor, who has been very outspoken and very much committed to putting climate solutions and energy solutions as a forefront of his agenda. And what we're actually starting to see is, instead of having advocacy for climate change is happening, global warming is real, where everyone who was involved with the climate movement was like, yes, we need to just get that basic agreement that this is happening, this is real. Now we're actually starting to see disagreement, which is in a way good, because we've got the basic alignment. So now we're disagreeing on the sequence, the relative investment, the kind of what might be catalytic, what might be more of an outcome after you do other things. And this is where we need to build agreement now at a higher level and actually dig out those points of conflict, not just saying, yes, we're all on the same team here. And we are all on the same team, but we actually need to find, why do you think that needs to go first? Or why do you think this is a policy solution versus a infrastructure solution, right? And those are the kinds of conflicts that we actually need to have that involve the movement piece of like, yes, we're aligning on these goals, and the industry piece of what are the benefits? And some of those benefits might be monetary, and some of them might be branding, and some of them might be all those things that we don't tend to think of as kind of elevated spiritual goals. But, you know, if there are lower incidents of childhood asthma and childhood obesity, there is a lower cost to the healthcare system, and that you can put a value on and say there's a social value to that.
I love so much of this, especially this point you're making, Renee, about how important it is for us to actually talk about what we agree and disagree on as it relates to the tactics. It's something I think a lot about at the scale of sort of national, you know, mission-driven organizations that are trying to, I think we assume because we kind of are playing in the same area. And as you said, because we are all generally in agreement about the end points, that we probably have the same opinion about the pathways to get there, but we really don't. And we need to spend that time. So it's great to hear about that from your perspective and to know that you're working on that. And, you know, that the state of Washington is a really great place to create new policies these days. So that's exciting. So I guess maybe related to this point, it's our second to last question about where you thought we would be in the 2020s. You know, you talked a little bit about sort of the arc of how the dialogue has shifted in the past couple of decades. But I think it's more a question of like how has the reality of our experience addressing these sort of multiple crises, how is that compared to where you thought the built environment world would be in the 2020s? Or like, you know, did you have dreams of flying cars and things?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the 2030 challenge came out when that seemed like such a long ways, but I think most people realized that there was a kind of urgency, and that we also, the social justice movement that was really elevated in people's awareness around George Floyd's murder had been around since, you know, the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, right? So some of these things we've been aware of. And, you know, when we look at those maps that compare redlining districts with, you know, life expectancy or, you know, college education or all those kinds of measures of kind of thriving communities, these things have been built over a long period of time, right? And so when we say, you know, when I first started teaching in the 2000s, or even in the late, you know, 1990s, where did we think we would be? Well, you know, the arc of justice is extremely long and slow and can look like nothing when you're trying to look at just one segment of it. And so I am happy, and you had asked me earlier what I felt like I had accomplished, that I've been around long enough to see somewhat the curve of the arc. And so that has been encouraging, whether or not it's, you know, as extreme of a bend as I was hoping when I first started teaching, at least there's been something. And I think that's important to keep that optimism, that potentially with more awareness and more tools, and I don't just mean technological tools, I definitely mean the cultural tools, we can potentially accelerate. And so I would say in some ways it can be, you know, pretty discouraging to say, you know, here we are, and there were so many things that have been identified. Like, you read some of the writing, you know, from like 1950 or 1960, and you're just like, yep, those are the same problems we're facing today. And that can feel super discouraging. On the other hand, you can say, all right, well, discussions are different. The types of work students are doing in school is different. The types of jobs that they're getting out when they leave is different. The types of ways that certain practices for sure are pioneering new pathways, you start to say, okay, it's not all been stagnation. yes, there are big issues that we continue to grapple with, but we our job is really to move things forward so that progress continues.
I love that. It feels like a very like sober but accurate, you know, kind of assessment of where we are. If you focus too much on sort of like the end metrics, then it may not feel like we're making as much progress, but foundations and the space.
Structural stuff, right? I mean, this is structural stuff that we're starting to get into. We've actually solved some of the easier things, right? Like building optimization, we've gotten a lot better at. But we haven't necessarily solved some of the behavioral things, or even, you know, when we talk about materials and their performance, we tend to focus still on first costs and trying to get more people thinking about life cycle costs. But what we haven't really considered are things that have to do with the supply chain and the human cost, right? There's a whole movement that Design for Freedom, that Grace Farms Foundation has been really great at trying to make more public and more people aware that modern slavery is alive and well in the building industry. And as an architect, when you specify steel, you don't necessarily know if that iron ore was mined in ways that used enslaved labor or had a horrible environmental impact compared to iron ore that was fair trade or responsibly mined, right? You don't know that. It's not transparent. And so as we get further into understanding, there are, you know, major areas that we can come together on and say, this is important for us to know. We're, you know, we represent globally billions of dollars of materials as we specify. And we can think about it in terms of sustainability of the environmental impact of the cost to produce, potentially the cost to transport, but we haven't really dealt with the human costs that is really opaque in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's an important area. Thank you for that. And I do think that's part of what it means to get to the foundation of things. Okay, well, there's so much more we could talk about clearly, but we are almost out of time. And so we're going to wrap up with this question that I honestly, I'm so excited to hear your answer because I feel like so many people I know are inspired by you. So it's like this fun question of who inspires the person.
Thanks. Yeah, well, I've been thinking about this. You warned me that this question was coming and I've been, the list keeps getting longer. So yeah, let's see if I can answer it in time.
Yeah. Tell us.
Okay. So, well, you asked more specifically about climate and built environment leaders. And so in our college, starting closest to home, so Kate Simonen and the Carbon Leadership Forum has been incredible to see how they've been able to really galvanize a lot of those discussions and a lot of her observations around, you know, finding the points of conflict and having disagreements around the sequencing come from my discussions with her. So I always learn so much every time I talk with her. We also have at our university incredible leaders among the Board of Deans and would not have survived the COVID years without them. But particularly Maya Tolstoy, who's the Dean of the College of Environment. And we often get confused for one another, but she is such a great partner. And that includes oceanography and forestry and atmospheric and a bunch of things that are really critical at this, you know, global scale. And then within a core group of people that I've been working with for a very long time is, you know, Laura Lee, who is currently in Europe, Phil Bernstein at Yale, Billy Faircloth at Karen Timberlake, Daniel Friedman, who was here at University of Washington before me. And then those that I don't actually know as well, that I just am super inspired by their work, are people like Wanda Del Costa, Kofi Boone. You know, when I hear some of these talks and I just think, oh my God, I don't have enough hours in the day to follow up on all these great references that they're giving in terms of books and more things that I want to read and think about and projects, examples of things that are moving forward. And then, of course, all my former students and my current students are absolutely inspiring. I find on the quarters that I don't teach, and I'm not teaching this quarter, which is, I really miss it, because being able to be challenged by students and to partner with them on things that they're interested in, hearing their points of view, is, I have realized over the long arc of my career, if I don't have regular contact with students in a classroom setting or a studio setting, I really start to feel drained. And so my recharge is actually my students.
Yeah, I get that. I, having taught a little bit recently, I feel like, Yeah, what a well of energy they can give. And yeah, no, I appreciate that. Okay, so many great people. Thank you for that incredible list, Renee. And thank you.
I'm sure I've left people off. I'm sure I apologize to all those that I've left off.
That's all right. You, as you said, you know, you got a lot of things that you'd like to be reading and thinking about. And so it's great to just get even a little sample of that. So yeah, thank you. And thanks so much for being with us. It's been an honor, a pleasure. I feel like you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. And thanks, Kira. Love you.
It's a pleasure as always. Thank you so much.
Well, that is it for us this week on the Design the Future podcast. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. Please leave us a review on Apple. It really matters. It helps people find us. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.